Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome back someone who needs no introduction here, the editor, among many other things, of Technocracy News, Patrick Wood. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you, Catherine. Always good to be with you. Nice to see your face. And we're sitting thousands of miles apart, and yet it's just like you're in the other room.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I felt more and more urged to talk with you. And then this week we're publishing an interview with Jacob Nordegren from Sweden. And so in the interview, he and I just start talking about how wonderful you are and how much we've drawn on your work. And it was old home week, you know, with Patrick. And so I asked our team to put a blast. You know, we do a blast from the past every week. And the blast of the past is all your interviews on the Soleri Report. So that just published, I think, today. And but when I had a breakthrough, I've been working for literally years to figure something out, as you know, and I had a huge breakthrough. And the first person I wanted to talk with was you, because I said, you know, here's something we can use to really make progress, but we need all of us. We need all of our power. Okay, whose power do we need? Patrick Wood.
I appreciate that.
Anyway, so anything you want to tell everyone about, tell them about where to find you and your great books and your websites and everything else.
Everything they need to know is on technocracy.news. That's Technocracy News and Trends. And if anybody's wondering, why am I talking about this today when I've been talking about technocracy for 15 years, I should probably explain that my original career was in finance and was in researching finance issues and economic issues and forecasting and trends and stuff like that. But when technocracy came along, I realized it was so important. I dropped all that stuff. And I just, you know, chased after technocracy as an economic system, as an economic issue. So my career is blended, and maybe that's the right way to say it. And so originally I was tracking after a lot of stuff that Professor Anthony Sutton was, you know, chasing after, and I've never forgotten that. So I continued to write about it, whatever. And somewhere around 2007 is when I kind of let that go. It was very hard to let it go. You might imagine this is kind of the love of my life, right? But I had to do what I'm doing today. So I have some backlog on this issue stuff, and it needs to be exposed. I'm thrilled that you're on the hunt here, and that you're going to give this some airtime.
Yeah. So I think we're looking at the pipes that are financing technocracy and making it possible.
Yes.
Because it's terribly uneconomic. It's terribly uneconomic. So you need a group of very secretive central bankers to just force the economics to go. Yes. It was interesting when I was having this breakthrough, and we're going to be talking about the Bank of International Settlements. I was in the process of briefing a young man. He's 26 years old, and he's constantly asking me for the best books. And I just pulled out the Wall Street Trilogy by Sutton, and we started talking about you and Sutton and why he had to read that book. And you know, he looked at me, sort of looked at the table of contents. He said, "I guess you're telling me that nothing ever changes." And I said, "Well, it can, but first we've got to expose the game."
That's right. Exactly right.
Anyway, so I have a PowerPoint that I want to use today. Can you see that?
I sure can.
Okay. So our topic, this is a special Soleri Report, and that means it's going to be public, because this is something we need a very wide discussion about. It's called "The Iron Bank is BIS Sovereign Immunity, the Secret Sauce Behind the Global Coup." And one of the things, if you do a search trying to learn about the immunities of the Bank of International Settlements, one of the things you learn, Patrick, is the best piece you find is a 2005 piece you wrote. So I want to show two videos as we start. Because I think they tee up the conversation we want to have. The first is my only experience with a central banker telling the truth.
All our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash. And there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that. Those two issues are extremely important, and that makes a huge difference with respect to what cash is.
I mean, essentially what he has is we're going to have absolute control of the rules of regulation and the technology to enforce it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me just go to the next one.
It's possible that even if you have to have CBDC in some form, that you're not destroying the banking system. If you do it the way China is doing it, now, you have to remember, China only recently introduced their banking system, and it seems they were not willing to already give it up. They have already CBDC. It's still a pilot project, but it's introduced, you know, among millions of people already. But it was introduced on purpose in such a way that it would not harm the banking system, and therefore is a more truthful sort of update of the old paper money. But of course, it still has the control aspects. At least it's not killing the banking system. The way they do this is by requiring you to have a bank account in order to get CBDC. So it's not a direct account at the central bank. It's only through your bank that you can get it. You see how simple that is. And of course, could be done over here, but they're not discussing it. Say, the ECB is not discussing it because you see their agenda is to get rid of banks. But this alternative exists. But then, of course, the key problem is this control aspect, which at the moment they haven't stepped up in China, but that can be introduced any time. And that, of course, is a concern. Also, they never talk about the nature of this CBDC. What is it actually going to look like? They never talk about that. Right. But I heard one European central banker tell me what it's going to look like. He saw it. He was invited to one of the old central banks in Europe that are very much promoting this, and they showed him. And you know, he's a top executive director of another central bank in Europe, and there's no reason to believe that he was telling me a story. And it was around this large and would be implanted under your skin. So that is the plan.
Right.
And of course, that has other implications on top of what we've mentioned, on top of the control aspects, because that actually enters your body. In my view, violates human dignity, and can be then used for even in terms of functionality beyond the monetary and economic transaction purposes. So highly dangerous and definitely something we have to oppose. And so using cash is one of the things we can do to make sure that the hurdle will be higher for the central planners to introduce the CBDC.
Mm-hmm. In a way, it's no surprise because, the WEF guys have basically, the Nokia guy at the WEF said that, you know, the chip's going to be in your hand. So, but for Richard Werner to confirm this, it had a very, the video has a very distinct impact. Mm-hmm. And if you go to our website, if you just click on cash every day on the homepage, mm-hmm. you can see it. Anyway, so okay. That's, sorry, I was hoping to play that for you because it's very impactful. Okay. So let's continue with the Bank of International Settlements. For those who are not as familiar with the Bank of International Settlements as you or I, it is an enterprise in Switzerland created in 1930 with sovereign immunity. The reason was supposedly reparations, but that reason quickly went away. And the Hague Convention of 1936 really flushed out its sovereign immunities, which we're going to talk about more. And which, if you want to understand the sovereign immunities, go do a search for Patrick's piece in 2005 on that, because you clearly understood the dangers here. Patrick, you've understood all along. It's governed by a self-perpetuating board of directors. There are currently 63 central banks and monetary authorities who are members. Russia apparently has just been put on probation. And they are extending their sovereignty with innovation hubs all around the world. They've negotiated treaties with sort of the different locations that they've put the hubs in. And the hubs are designed to basically create the CBDCs and coordinate the intelligence and sort of operations of those activities. I had always thought of the BIS as sort of a regulator and policy shop, a coordinator. And they do, you know, on their website, you'll find some very good research. But in fact, they have gold, they have bank deposits, they have securities data, regulatory standards. But, you know, if you look at their sort of global pipes, they have the ability on behalf of their members to basically run global pipes behind sovereign immunity and behind complete secrecy around the world. And, you know, it started off with just their members. But if you look at their basically their governing documents, it includes deposits for others. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and you look at it and you think, who is others?
Yep. Exactly right.
That's pretty wide open.
That's right. There's a special relationship that the BIS has with all of the other shareholders, let's say, which are normally this other central banks. In the United States, there's three other banks that have a share in the BIS. JP Morgan Chase is one. But when it comes to the concept of agency, the BIS has a standing authority to act as agent for any of its constituents and vice versa.
Right.
And this is really important. It's like, you know, everybody understands your insurance agent is the guy or the gal that binds an insurance policy for you. They talk to the insurance company. Oh yeah, then we'll write a policy on Fitz and then they settle out the finances later. That's an agency. So what that means is that when the BIS reaches out and wants to do something in China or in America or in Europe or wherever, they have the ability to act as agents for those entities. And it turns around the other way too. They can appoint those people as their agents to do stuff. And that basically includes any other bank, any other member bank in any of the BIS, any of the central banks. They right. can appoint them as agents as well. And when that happens, all of a sudden, you remember the old Maxwell Smart movie where the cone of silence came down?
Yeah. the cone of silence extends to anybody they designate as an agent, including experts they hire.
That's right.
They could hire Patrick Wood as an expert, and you could go to the meeting and engage in all sorts of criminality and leave, and you're completely protected according to their construct.
For life. That's forever.
Right. Right. I would point out that they accept in certain conditions traffic accidents. You know, you wonder how that happened, but there is an exception.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and it's when you read in and you dig into the actual language, and it's all up on their website or, you know, the language for their innovation hubs, everything, it's quite extraordinary.
Yes.
So, the thing I think that has really dramatically extended the power of this sovereign immunity syndicate is what you would call, well, let's first go into their agreement. So if you look at their governing documents, they have immunity for the members of the board of directors, the officers, the bank staff, the representatives of the member banks and experts. And that includes guests. You can just invite a whole bunch of people to a meeting with the BIS, and the next thing you know, you're covered. Mm-hmm. So if you want to engage in RICO conspiracy, it's pretty convenient. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And it includes their premises. So it's their premises, but it also includes, you know, when they as a group travel and go somewhere. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really recommend, if you're interested in this, we put some links in here to describe how to do it, but is your wonderful piece in 2005 that you published. Why don't you tell us about that piece and what inspired you to publish it?
Well, I published it as a trilogy, actually. And it was a necessary thing to do. And I, by the way, I did put all those articles in this little book called Globalization, The Crucible of Global Banking.
Uh-huh.
And all three of my articles from 2005 are in this little booklet. And I finally did that because a lot of people were asking, where's this article, that article? I finally said, I'm just going to put all those three in a book. And it was a small little book. It's not very big, but I figured it would just take the heat off. I could just say, hey, get the book and you get them all. But the three banks that work together, or monetary entities work together in the world to accomplish their goals, is the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the Bank for International Settlements. You cannot have one without the other. That's an important key. They work together as a pack. They're like a pack of wolves. They hunt together. Each one of them has a different function, however. As you kind of look at it and look from the top down, big picture, each one has a different role. Each one has different, functions and different abilities. But the BIS is the organization that I think calls the shots, truly. And then they, whatever the case is, then they work together as three in one to accomplish whatever it is that they want to do, whether it's moving money from here to there, whether it's accomplishing something in a certain country, a regime change, even, bankrupting a company, taking them down, all their country altogether. There's all kinds of things that the three of these have done over the years that would just set your hair on fire.
Right.
And it's brazen. And it's so criminal, but they're untouchable. This is the issue. They're absolutely untouchable.
They're also very quiet.
Well, they are. They have no reason. Why would they say anything? They've got a complete cloak of silence that they don't need to say anything.
They have the cone of silence. They have the
cone of silence. And you can't force them to say anything. Except that they say it voluntarily, you can't force them to do it.
Right.
And we'll talk about the secrecy aspect that, The BIS has the ability to extend its cone of silence out into these other organizations like the IMF and like the World Bank, because when they collaborate with each other, all of a sudden you find, for instance, that people or maybe sections of the World Bank are acting as agent for the BIS. Right. So all of a sudden the cone of silence falls on that whole group and there's nothing comes out of it. It's a black hole. You can't penetrate what they have done. There's no way to tell what they've done, and they're not going to volunteer it.
I don't think they call the shots. I think they're the plumbers who work for the guys who call the shots.
Well, you'd have to say that generally. I think there's always going to be a group of masterminds behind the whole thing, but they still have to be involved with the BIS. And what we see in terms of membership, for instance, just this example, you've got they meet every 2 months. The heads of the central banks are supposed to go to Basel every 2 months to meet in a round table in their building, the little crazy looking building. It looks like the Tower of Babel, in my opinion. But they go there and they meet in this big round table and they have their discussions. We never know what they say because it's secret.
Secret.
You can't tell. You're not supposed to say anything. So within all of the central banks of the world, there is a core that basically kind of calls the shots for the rest of them. The weak hands, the ones from South America and Africa and Africa area, they're not so heavily represented in this core group for sure. Right. But the U.S. is, the ECB is, Japan is, China is probably now too.
Yeah.
And these are the guys that kind of, they're the clique within the clique that said, this is where we're going to head next. And so you can look at those. You can look at even J.P. Morgan Chase, for instance. It's very tight with for international settlements. They have a role in BIS does.
The BIS in about 2000 squeezed out most of the private shareholders. Are you saying it wasn't all the private shareholders? Because the New York Fed owned shares and the...
Yes.
And the Fed owns shares.
Yes.
And both the New York Fed and the Fed are represented on the board.
Yes.
It was a self-perpetuating board, so it wouldn't have to be that way. But I was not aware that J.P. Morgan still directly owns some.
They do own, as far as I, as far as I know at this point, I haven't really dug deeply into it in the last couple of years. As far as I know, they still own their 16,000 shares, I think it was originally given out.
Right.
Now, having said that, back in 2003, for some reason, nobody really knows why, again, clone of silence, I suppose, they closed off private ownership.
So I have shares. A theory, and I'd love to show you my theory.
And I don't think it was J.P. Morgan Chase that got thrown out of that mix, by the way, when they say
there's
private.
No reason for them, because basically they and Citibank are the controlling party in the New York Fed. Why would they throw them out?
That's right. Exactly right. It doesn't make any sense. So there must have been some other private individuals that somehow got stock.
Yeah. It was right.
BIS. Your theory.
So I'm gonna go back and let me pull up the recalcitrant PowerPoint. Okay, so let me go back to screen share. So what really, after your article and the book Tower of Basel, let me do this screen share game again. What really helped me out was John Titus's video, All the Plenary's Men.
Mm-hmm.
What he did is he really did a deep dive on the HSBC settlement with the Department of Justice, where the Department of Justice allowed HSBC to skate both officers and enterprise criminal prosecution in 2012. And the question, literally what he does is he traces the BIS sovereign immunity into what's called the systemically important banks, insurers, and payment systems. And he describes how the Bank of England intercedes and asserts systemically important banks. So I think the reason that they... that the sort of the miscellaneous private investors got squeezed out, except for the owners of the central bank, was they created a syndicate called the systemically important banks. Then they created the systemically important financial institutions, which is basically insurers. You're looking here at a list of the banks as of 2021 and the insurers as of 2016. They haven't updated it. They also have something called the systemically important payment systems, and we've never gotten a list of names that I know of. And I think what they did is they put together a mechanism, which I would argue is on shaky grounds, that extends their sovereign immunities and agency through all these insurers, payment systems, and banks.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Fed going on the buying their shares in 94 and the $21 trillion starting to go missing in October 1997, essentially 3 years later, what made that syndicate go, particularly through the financial crisis, was the protection that this syndicate offered all those institutions. Because mm-hmm. now you're not just depending on the IMF and the World Bank and the BIS, but you can extend it significantly throughout the financial system, and you can move trillions of dollars in secrecy.
Yes. And that secrecy is selective. I think Titus brought that out in his video. And the problem in determining what hat they're wearing at the time is very difficult.
Right.
And if you don't understand kind of how it works in the first place, you'll just go on thinking, well, they're wearing the same hat. And
that's
but you don't
mistake.
Really realize they've changed hats, and all of a sudden they're representing somebody else.
Well, here's the thing: you're the New York Fed, and you say, "Oh, well, that was me as primary dealer, J.P. Morgan." Say, "Oh, well, this is me as depository at HUD. It's really the Treasury. It's not the New York Fed, or it's J.P. Morgan, or this is me as the servicer for this portfolio at HUD, and then this is me. I'm acting as an agent in the BIS, and they can just keep flipping." You know, it's like a coat rack, and they just keep, you know, spinning it around and showing you another coat.
Yes, exactly. like the dry cleaner that has the rack and
exactly.
it goes around, around, around.
Exactly.
You know, if one was an attorney and could sit in front of, you know, and like get a deposition from some of these people, everything that every answer you got from a question, you should follow up that answer with another question. Okay, I hear what you just said.
Right.
Are you acting on your behalf, this person's behalf, or this person's behalf? Right.
You got it. You got his pin. And they're like slither. That's what you used to call on Wall Street, slither. They yes. just slither around. Okay. So at the heart of this syndicate, you know, so BIS to me is at the very center of the syndicate, mm-hmm. and it's all about secrecy and immunity. The quote I had at the top of the introduction I sent you that I did for the first quarter wrap up was from the cabinet secretary at HUD when I worked there. He said, the law, I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority. And I think, Patrick, it's very important to understand that when you create a syndicate like this and they start operating above the law, you know, they're doing lots of transactions and things which are criminal under the national laws. They believe that they're totally above the law and they enter into a parallel existence and they can never come back.
Yes. Yes. Would it be worthwhile to read what Carol Quigley had to say about the
BIS? Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you have it there?
I do. I have it right in front of me. This is 1966 when he wrote Tragedy and Hope, or at least when it was published, Macmillan. And this appeared on page 308. If there's any naysayers or skeptics out there that want to go look it up, there you go. It's page 308. I'm reading from it. Now, Quigley was an interesting character because he kind of played both sides. He didn't play him against the middle, but he documented a lot of what was going on amongst the global elite. And he was a Georgetown University historian. So he's very well respected in his field. And he is not one of us, I have to say. He's not, right. He wouldn't be sitting here at the table with me if he was around today. This is what he wrote. The power of financial capitalism had another far-reaching plan, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This is 1966.
Right.
This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. It was exactly what we're talking about here.
Right.
The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations.
Right.
Each central bank in the hands of men like Montague Norman at the Bank of England, Benjamin Strong at the New York Fed, Charles Rist of the Bank of France, and Halmar Schacht of Reichsbank, sought to dominate its government by its agility to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in each country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent rewards in the business world.
Right.
That's
that, exactly,
you know,
what has happened.
It's exactly what's happened. And who missed this? I mean, this was a book. It was written by a very well-known, famous historian.
I think a lot of people didn't miss this. You've published this. You know, many people have read Quigley. I think most people believe that this was not something you had to worry about in their lifetime.
Yeah. Yes, I probably so. Yeah, it was just,
right.
You know, economics is boring. Finance is even more boring. And people, oh no, another economic lecture, and you know, they go to sleep. might as well start sleeping right away. And it's hard to get people excited about economic issues. You get excited about politics.
It's harder to get them excited about financial responsibility and fiscal responsibility in their government. Right.
Yes.
And that's what the BIS and the syndicate has done. They've put every sovereign government in a debt trap.
Yes, they have. Right. They absolutely have. And they own them at this point. They own the whole cotton picking kit and caboodle. And the rest of it basically is mirage. It's like, really, it's like the Wizard of Oz right now. We're wandering around like the scarecrows or the Tin Mans or the whatever, and thinking that, you know, we're looking at reality. And behind it, there's a whole nother thing being played out.
BIS is the tunnel system beneath Disney World.
Yes, that's right.
So,
right.
So I just wanted to show one other thing on our PowerPoint. It's on its way in the mail to you, and that is the hard copy for our annual wrap-up. We publish the wrap-ups let me get this playing. So we publish the wrap-ups in January, but then, you know, then they come out in PDF, then they come out in hard copy. And it's all about sovereignty. And it's a wonderful piece by John Titus. And it follows up on the pieces that we've done on state of our currency, then going direct reset, then CBDC, vaccine passports, and then taxation. But what I try and tell everybody, particularly people who are working in their states to try and protect their sovereignty, is we don't have an economic or financial problem. This is our problem. You know, are we going to be individually sovereign? And are we going to be represented by governments who are also have sovereignty? And how do we create and protect that sovereignty? And one of the reasons I wanted to kind of kick off this discussion with you is there are more technology problems today than I have seen in a long time, Patrick.
That's topically oriented, you understand. Sure. Oh, yes.
Yeah, you're special. You're special. You were always special. Okay, so where was I before I was fisticuffing with? To me, the question, of course, is what do we do? And so I wanted to do this interview with you because I want a wider discussion of what's been happening. I think we've created literally a breakaway civilization with thousands of bankers, financial people, people at the IMF and monetary policy who are stuck over in their parallel existence and they can't come back. Even if they don't like what's happening now, even if they see where this is going, they can't afford to lose their immunity. There's no process to win them back over to our team. So they're stuck, and we literally have divided into two civilizations, and one has no obligation. They have to worry about our laws, but they think they're immune from our laws. And they literally operate, you know, it's a multiple personality disorder planet. And I think if you look at how they've extended the immunities, not just through the systemically important institutions, but now also through the innovation hubs, I think they're on very weak legal grounds. I don't think they've really got it. I think they're doing it and they're presuming it, but I don't think it can hold. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I see an opportunity.
Yeah. I agree with you. There are opportunities and it's not over till it's over.
Right.
And it's not over. So you can say, as long as it's not over, we're still going to be in the battle and try and derail this whole thing, to throw a monkey wrench in. And it's not going to be easy because of the secrecy and the lack of accountability. We can't rely any way, shape, or form on our legal system in any country to touch these people. You can't sue them. You can't charge them criminally. They're completely immune.
Traffic accidents.
That's traffic accidents. That's right. It's about it. That's right. But nevertheless, awareness is the first step towards healing.
Right.
If nobody understands the problem in the first place, they're never going to understand what or figure out what the answer could be to it. And this is one of the most important topics, I think, in the whole world, because, you know, most people, they're living their lives down on the street level and they're getting along. They've got a job. They got a car. They got kids, you know, and they're just merrily going along life. They don't know what the BIS is doing or whether they're stealing $20 trillion or not. And they really, on one hand, they just don't care. It says, hey, life is good for me.
Right.
And life is good for my neighbor and my family. You know, we're doing okay. And so life goes on and they don't pay attention to any of these things. But when they wake up to see the master skullduggery that's being executed on a world stage, things change. Attitudes change. Resistance changes. Compliance changes. This is an important one. You know, more and more people today are opting out of complying with this whole thing.
Right.
And they're just saying, I'm not going to play ball with that anymore. Forget it, man. There's poison over there. It's like you bought property next to a toxic dump or something, you know. I'm not, no, you children can't go over there. We're staying away from that. I see people that are pulling away and saying, I'm just not going to support that anymore. And of course, it's difficult. In some cases, you still end up supporting them to some extent because we live here and Right. They've got control of the system.
Right.
But there are lots of things that we can do. You suggested some of them. Using cash and stuff, for instance, is a great way to,
right.
Even if it's not effective as a tool itself, it raises awareness
Yes. In
a huge way. Everybody I talk to, we've been practicing. My wife and I have been practicing this Cash Friday at first. And every time we talk to a young person behind a counter on Friday, we say, you know why I'm giving you cash today? And, oh, I don't have a clue. I'm giving you care. Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
And we give them the story about cashless banking and how dangerous it is. Did you ever think what would happen to your bank account if the internet went down? What if your bank just went offline and all of a sudden your debit card doesn't work anymore? I never thought of that. You know, and I'm going to do that too, you know? And all of a sudden you've got a concrete, tangible touch on somebody that never had a clue before. Right. And I'm telling you, there are thousands of people I know around the world that are being touched today by something just as simple as that.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't work to derail the BIS, it's okay because it's waking people up like crazy. Absolutely. And that's really what we need.
But I do think something, I do think these things in combination can derail the BIS.
Yes.
Have you heard reports from Ireland about what happened there?
Vis-a-vis taxes or?
No, you had a huge group of Irish banks say they were going to cancel cash.
Literally
a revolution. And I haven't seen much in the press. We've posted a couple of stories, but there's really not much coverage. Apparently Breitbart has a story today, but I haven't seen it. But I've gotten reports from subscribers or colleagues, and it was a real revolution. One guy told me he was on a train going to Dublin or into some city center, and an 80-year-old guy was riding in to cancel an account he'd had since he was a young man, and he was going to give him a piece of his mind.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. But, all the stories that come back to us of people who use cash is it starts conversations.
Yes.
And it starts conversations about how do we help ourselves do better locally here?
Right.
How do we do this? So I don't know. What I want to inspire in part with this interview is the healthcare people and the doctors and scientists are struggling with all the indemnifications and immunities in the health area from the UN, from the WHO, from Gavi. And I think there's a very vicious squeeze between those sovereign immunities and indemnifications and the BIS and the financial guys. Because they're printing money and piping it around secretly, and then the healthcare guys are being financed with it to do these things and also think they're above the law.
Yes.
So it's, again, it's this breakaway civilization. Yes. But we're all in our little lane dealing with it, and we're not connecting the dots together.
Right. I love to connect the dots. That's my life's passion and always has been. So, hey, listen, I got this list here of immunity items.
Oh, go through.
Bullet pointed it. I mean, people, I say friends who are listening to this, okay, you're not going to believe this. It's going to potentially set your hair on fire. So I have a bucket of water handy just in case. This is just a summary, mind you, of bullet points I picked out from their actual charter. They have diplomatic immunity for persons and what they carry with them. That is diplomatic pouches. And when I say diplomatic immunity, that's like embassies have from place to place. Can't touch them. You've all seen movies on TV where some crime gets committed and all of a sudden there's some ambassador from Sri Lanka or something involved. And he says, I have diplomatic immunity, man. I'm out of here. Can't charge me. And he walks off, right? That's the way diplomatic immunity is. No taxation on any transactions, including salaries paid to employees. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I can.
No taxation. They have no consequences whatsoever. No taxes. No salaries, no salary withholding, anything like that taken out. Tax-free money given to you.
So they can trade on inside information, and when they do and make profits, there's no capital gains tax, right?
That's right. It's beautiful. Here's another one. They have embassy-type immunity for all their buildings and or offices operated by the BIS. So anywhere the BIS puts its label on or, you know, placard on a door, they have an embassy immunity. And you remember Julian Assange that was taking up, residence in the embassy in England. They couldn't touch him. Nobody could go in and get him because it was an embassy. It was immune from that. Here's another one. No oversight or knowledge of operations by any government authority. No government has the right or the ability, nor will they let them in, to understand or to acquire information from the BIS and what they're doing. It absolutely are immune from that. There's another one, freedom from immigration restrictions. Right. They can go anywhere in the world. We saw this back in the Sutton brought this up from, he knew a senior United Airlines pilot, really senior. He was like getting ready to retire. Said that David Rockefeller was able to fly without passport into Russia anytime he wanted to, USSR, anytime he wanted to.
Right. I'm sure that's true.
And yeah, and he wouldn't have to report it to anybody, but he'd fly in and fly out. And everybody else, of course, you might get shot down by missiles or something. Here's another one. Freedom to encrypt any and all communications of any sort.
See, I think this is the most powerful.
Oh, yes. You can still use the internet, but it's so encrypted that you can encrypt anything you want. Here's another one. Freedom from any legal jurisdiction. Okay, now how many? There are 197 nations in the world. They all have legal jurisdictions. If you go into a country and you commit war crimes or something, just say that, for example, I'm not accusing them of that, but you go into any country and do something wrong, that country can't reach out and either touch you legally or the BIS legally. They are immune from any legal jurisdiction. They're above the law, literally above the law, and could do anything they want to do.
And I just want to point that above the law, let's say you participate in a meeting where you conspire to destroy a country like Syria, and you have immunity for the rest of your life.
That's right. It goes on forever. And this is some of the stuff that's brought up. And I'm reading this, by the way. This all comes directly from their own charter. Immunity from arrest or imprisonment and immunity from seizure of their personal baggage, save only in flagrant cases of criminal offense. So I guess if they're caught holding a suitcase at a murder crime, holding the knife or gun, whatever, they could take their suitcase, possibly as an out. Here's another one, inviolability of all papers and documents. It doesn't matter whether they're from the BIS or not. Here's another one, immunity from jurisdiction, even after their mission has been accomplished and for acts carried out in the discharge of their duties, including words spoken and writings.
Right.
Exemption for themselves, listen, their spouses and their children. From any immigration restrictions, from any formalities concerning the registration of aliens, and from any obligations relating to national service in Switzerland. It's another one.
The right to use any domestic staff problems.
No. The right to use codes in official communication or to receive or send documents or correspondence by means of couriers or diplomatic bags. So they can encrypt their communications like, you know, we used to do in World War II. And, you know, this just goes on. The last few things that I pulled out is they have immunity from jurisdiction for acts accomplished in discharge of their duties, including words spoken in writings, even after such persons have ceased to be officials of the bank.
Right.
They have exemption from all federal, cantonal, and communal taxes on salaries, fees, and allowances paid to them by the bank. They're exempt from Swiss national obligations because they're based in Switzerland.
Right. Freedom for spouses. Serve in the military.
That's right. Freedom for spouses and family members from immigration restrictions. And I dare people, just try to get into Switzerland and take up residence there. You're going to have a hard road to go. They can transfer assets and properties, including internationally, with the same degree of benefits as officials of other international organizations. So even individuals can launder money without any oversight, legal jurisdiction, nothing. This is the most incredible. The way they set this up originally is still in effect now. This is such an incredibly outrageous proposition for humanity that I've ever seen in my life. There's nothing like it in the world. This is unprecedented.
Well, except for this, I would say the Vatican has enjoyed 2,000 years of diplomatic immunity and freedom from taxation.
Yes, and that's true, too.
Has,
you're right.
The city has extraordinary powers. And if you, I mean the City of London, and if you look at how this relates to the City of London and the Vatican, it's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the pieces of this syndicate is the British offshore havens coming out of the city.
Yeah. Yes.
And the Bank of England was instrumental in engineering the creation of the BIS.
Yes.
And if you look at the board, it's always heavily populated with the central bankers from the Anglo-American Alliance.
Yes, absolutely. And I dare say that I haven't, but Sutton traced the BIS activity with the Catholic Church during World War II. We don't want to talk about it. I don't want to get all my Catholic friends really mad at me. But he broke this down in spades. Yeah. I'm telling you, it was like horrible. And the City of London, my guess is the same type of revolving door.
Right.
Through which you can launder things and get things to show up some other area of the world that cannot be traced back to you. That's so just simple laundering principles.
One of the biggest questions I had was, how did they disappear the $21 trillion from the U.S. government? There's $21 trillion missing. Although I would point out that if you were laundering, you know, there was $6.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments in 2015. The last Obama year was the biggest year. And I would like to point out some of that could, in fact, have been an opposite direction. They could have been laundering money back in from, you know, through the army, through the Middle East. You know, so Afghanistan Central Bank could have been pumping it in the other way. But $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, I could never figure out how can you launder that much money? Because that's a lot of money. And I realized all you have to do is have a HUD account at Citibank or JPMorgan Chase, and they're acting as agent for the U.S. Treasury and, you know, running a HUD account. And right next to it, you've got an account where they're acting as an agent for the BIS because now they're a shareholder, and all they have to do is move it from one to the other. They send it through those pipes that you know very well. And the next thing you know, it ends up in Norway or New Zealand where they donate it back to the Clinton Foundation.
Yes.
Or they invest it back, the Sovereign Wealth Fund invests it back in Jeffrey Epstein's financial corporation in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Or you can even launder it in a way that it just ends up as profits in the mortgage portfolio at Berkshire Hathaway, who donates it to the Gates Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that piping system can pipe it secretly anywhere and make it turn up looking like something entirely different.
That's right. And it can't be traced because of the cone of silence that the BIS has on everything. So if J.P. Morgan Chase wants to get money, say, moved to Zelensky in the Ukraine, he could never do it directly. The J.P. Morgan Chase could never just say, because that has to be put on filings for the SEC and stuff.
Right.
Would never do that.
Right.
But if J.P. Morgan Chase had a credit or was able to put money to the New York Fed, let's say, and the New York Fed gives it to the BIS, which is their right to do, and the BIS gives it to the central bank in Ukraine, the central bank in Ukraine gives it to the equivalent or maybe even an agent or branch of J.P. Morgan over there.
Right.
They receive money.
It's back at J.P. Morgan Chase, but there's no...
That's right.
There's no connection.
The banking entity there has money to loan. And when you go in and say to the banker, I want to borrow $1 million, you don't ask him, where did you get the money that you're going to loan to me? Right? Wink, wink. You don't ask that question ever. The bank has money. Everybody assumes the bank has money and will loan you if they're willing to. They'll loan you whatever you want. So if you ask for $10 million or $500 million or whatever, if the bank figures you're a good risk, my friend, even though you're a terrorist or whatever, we'll give you $500 million. They can loan the money to that person with the money they receive from the liquidity from the BIS coming down through the central bank coming down to them. The loan is out there. The guy gets the money and the cash. He goes out and uses it for whatever purposes he wants to. And then if the money never gets paid back, well, there's other ways to take it out. You know, for instance, if the World Bank is involved, you can go and put in a claim, an insurance claim to the World Bank to have the taxpayers bail you out.
Right. Exactly.
Make up for the money.
Right. Exactly.
It's like, and none of it's traceable.
So here's what's interesting, though. When Dr. Mark Skidmore in 2017 did a complete survey of all the HUD and DOD accounts, at that point, I had found 12 trillion. He and his students found another 11 trillion. So it became 21 trillion. And right after he published his report, you know, I was clear, we can't publish until I have all the documents on multiple servers around the world. He thought I was paranoid. We got everything up in multiple servers around the world, and HUD and DOD, both IGs, took all the documents down on the same day. He could not believe it. And so we made a big hullabaloo about it because we had everything up on the server and it just all clicked in from my servers, at which point they put it back and said they were all just reorganizing their websites. But here's what's interesting. So we published that in, I think, the second or third week of September. In the first week of October, now, right before this happened, Patrick, the lead IT provider for all the payment systems at DOD and HUD spun its government IT division out of the company into a new company. And the new company was the company SAIC had done the same thing a year or two before. So these two companies shed all their liabilities into this new company, which also happens to be a huge contractor in Antarctica, believe it or not. Anyway, so they spin their IT divisions out, but we know that the New York Fed can't spin their liabilities out. And they are subject to national jurisdiction. So yeah. So the first week in October, the first Saturday, there was a fire on a Saturday night at the Fed. And the first reports, there were 100 fire trucks down at the New York Fed down on Wall Street. The first report came out and said the fire had happened on the roof because someone in the basement was using an old fireplace in the basement, and it caught the roof on fire because it hadn't been used a lot, which raises the question, on a warm October night, why is somebody using a fireplace in the basement of the New York Fed?
Jeez, can't make it up.
I know. So they do have liability. So one of my beliefs is that as a political matter, there are legal ways to get the $21 trillion back because the New York Fed as depository is legally obligated to conduct itself in a certain way. And we know the Department of Justice has a habit of asserting common law right of offsets against contractors who fail to perform, including, you know, for non-cash items. So it's a long, arcane legal discussion, but there's plenty of precedent that $21 trillion in common law right of offsets could be asserted against the New York Fed and any banks that acted as agent for the New York Fed in their role as depository and their role as primary dealer for the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So we're not without leverage because they are still subject to the laws of the land.
Yeah, yeah. Wherever there's opportunity to go after them with quote unquote the laws of the land, it should happen. Absolutely, should be exercised.
So let me ask you, what was the reaction to your 2005 article? Did people understand the dangers here?
A few did. You know, a few people, thinkers, readers, kind of got it. But, you know, I have to say, otherwise, it was a nothing burger for most people.
So, but you published it in 2005, but then we had the financial crisis.
Yes. Totally and predictable. Totally predictable. You know, I was able to see that narrative start from day one and just watch it play out. I was like waving the flag, guys, you know, look at this. And I know a few people looked. There were people who were following my work back then. They were looking at it and they were hopefully staying out of harm's way. But by and large, the average Joe out there had no clue what was going on. And the academics I dare say, and when I say academics, I'm kind of talking about, you know, the PhDs at Georgetown, you know, whatever, the people that are supposed to be paying attention to this kind of stuff. They didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't want anything. They wouldn't touch it. And who knows, maybe they had attended a BIS meeting one time and it had the cone of silence put over them and they didn't dare speak.
We know, it's interesting because I've dealt with a lot of people who go back and forth between the two civilizations.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, it's literally like they put on a different personality when they're in one versus the other. Yeah. And what's amazing is the quality of their lying. They are the best liars in the world because in a way they don't think they're lying. They think, okay, we have two worlds. You know, it's like crossing the border between France and Germany. You speak German here and you speak French here.
Right.
And here you've got the official narrative and here you've got reality. And you just, you know, this is, I'm in this world now and I speak this language and it's fine. And they seem perfectly natural and they sound totally like they're telling the truth, but they're lying through their teeth. And I've watched it, you know, I've watched it my whole life. And what's interesting is I'll never forget, I don't know if you remember, I was chasing Enron trying to understand whether they were using Enron to launder some of the money that was disappearing from HUD. Because the same contractors running HUD were also represented on the board of Enron. There was a lot of crossover. And the chairman of the finance committee at Enron testified saying, you know, I had no idea any of this was going on. And, you know, it was all Arthur Andersen's fault. And, you know, of course, I was able to point out that he continued to use Arthur Andersen on all of his other companies. And, of course, he knew everything that was going on, but he's a very good liar. And but what was possible at that point, I'll never forget somebody coming to me and saying, oh, I get it now. You know, in the old days, I would have listened and said, oh, what a wonderful guy, is from the right schools and the right companies, got a great resume. He's a wonderful guy. And now I realize he's just a mobster. And of course he's lying because that's what mobsters do. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're talking about with the resistance. Because I think what's going to happen is the veil's coming down and you're going to have millions of people realizing, you know, that guy next door, or, you know, who I run into at, you know, his son is going to the same school as my son. He's really doing this. Yeah. And he's lying. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's like dealing with the mob.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Indeed it is. Yeah. I'd never do a study like this, like what I would be cool to have. I will never be the person to do it. But I would love to analyze, say, going back, say, 30 years, every dime received by the United Nations and where every dime came from. Not so much what they did with it. What they did with it would be important too, but where the money came from would also be important.
Right.
Because it comes from national treasury. It comes from like the U.S. Treasury writes a check to fund the World Health Organization and their dues and so on for the United Nations. And it would be interesting to trace that money back. Okay, where did the money come from in the national treasuries? Was it already there before those payments were made, or did it suddenly show up as available?
Right.
To go to the United Nations, you see. And the reason I bring this up is that my analysis of the original Trilateral Commission debacle in the early 70s was that David Rockefeller and crowd knew that the currencies of the world were all going to go up in smoke because Nixon had just dumped the gold standard. That wasn't without their approval, by the way. They were involved there, up their necks in it. But after the gold standard was put away, Rockefeller knew that there would be a finite limit, mathematically certain, a finite limit to when currencies would finally just burn up and evaporate, all go away, all the fiat currencies of the world. And I do believe at that point, and they talked about it quite openly in a couple of their books that they put out, studies about accumulating physical natural resources, that is land issues, things to do with farming and timber and gold mines and whatever it might be around the world, where all wealth comes from. I think the logic they had as they took after this, especially looking at sustainable development, was to get all of the resources of the world out of your hands and into their hands.
Right.
And so that we would end up with nothing. Well, that's what Klaus Schwab says, right? You'll own nothing and be happy. And won't be happy, but you'll own nothing if he gets his way. Right. So if that were the case, that the United Nations is the primary accumulator of physical natural resources in the world through a number of things like heritage zones and other machinations they do. And they launder property. They're working very tightly with the BIS, the World Bank, and the IMF as well to put tracts of land out of the public domain.
And out of farmers' domain. Out of farmers' domain.
Yes. It would be interesting to see and trace that money, if it were possible, to see how much money that the UN received that actually went into sequestering physical resources for these people.
Right.
And we know that people like Bill Gates bought up already, just from his own money, he's bought up 236,000 acres of prime farmland in the United States. That's still a drop in the bucket compared to everything we have, but that's a lot of farming, a lot of land.
I gave a speech at 2017 at a crypto conference, and at the time, I quoted the land report, which is the 100 top landowners in the United States from the end of the fiscal crisis until that conference. So say 2012 to 2017, that top 100 owners had doubled their land holdings.
Somehow, whenever I see, you know, I've thought about your massive amount of money, and I realize on a global basis, it's much larger than 21 trillion. It's you know, if you look on a global basis, it could be 100, 150 trillion. Nobody knows.
Well, but the missing money was 21 trillion. The financial crisis was 27 to 29. And some of that could have been the securities fraud to finance the 21. So I'm not saying it's plus plus. Quantitative easing was much more. The going direct reset is 9 trillion with the ECB and the Fed. You know, we're talking about enough money to fund an endowment for a global government.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It just it just makes me wonder, you know, if somehow we could look down from space and see all the little sparks and quarks of money trails, I think we'd have quite a picture.
Well, but I agree with you. I think the money is totally irrelevant. What's relevant is the real assets.
Yes.
You know, money is something that they induce us with, but it's not real. They're after the real stuff, which is not just the land, but it includes us.
Yes, it does. And there was a time when having money was okay. When it was exchangeable into gold, for instance, and into other material assets, it was okay to own the whole money. You could be a wealthy person.
Right.
But, you know, you look back in the Old Testament, for instance, you look at Job. Job got rich not because he had, you know, $1 million or $1 billion in the bank of whatever. He was rich because he owned herds of cattle and ranches and sheep and gold mines and timber all that stuff. He was considered to be one of the richest person in the world. It was the physical assets that made him rich, not anything to do with money.
Right.
So when people would come to him and say, well, I'd like to have some of your sheep or whatever, they would have to work out an arrangement to trade something, some kind of a barter. Hey, what are you going to give me? And I'll give you some sheep. Today we use money, but money's no good anymore. And the bankers know that. They darn well know it. I know they jockey and they're crying the blues and we're being misused here.
Here's the thing. If you could swap money for energy, if you could print money out of thin air and swap it for oil, it would still worth something.
Yeah.
But
sure. This is my cynical opinion. Why spend your money on buying physical resources? You're a rich guy now, right? Why spend my money buying physical resources for me when I can do it with somebody else's money for free?
Right.
What are you going to choose? Of course,
take
it for free. Launder the money, turn it into physical assets. The title ends up in my name. Thank you very much. I'll sleep nice tonight.
Right. I think, you know, to me, it's so important to look through the financial balance sheets and into the real assets. It's, you know, what I say is all wealth comes from life. It doesn't. Yeah.
Gosh.